the average American liberal is likelier to agree with a French, British, German, or Canadian person on universal health care, gun control, or climate change than to agree with a fellow American conservative.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum here in Harvard Square. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight, in what some might consider rather doleful times for the country, we're going to consider the idea of American exceptionalism with author and Stanford Law Fellow Mugambi Dewey. Dewey has just published a book entitled Exceptional America, and in it he delves into the concept behind the word exceptional with its various ramifications. What has exceptionalism come to mean, both in our current climate of rhetorical newspeak and also in our country's historical parlance? Is America standing out or missing out? Raised in Paris and educated in Europe and America, Mugambi Dewey has studied and worked in several countries. He's worked both as a public defender in the New York courts and also as a defender at the war crimes trial conducted at the International Court in The Hague. In his new book, Dewey looks at why Americans are more divided than other Westerners over basic issues, including wealth inequality, healthcare, climate change, and abortion. Is America becoming more polarized, he asks, and does American exceptionalism explain these social changes? I'm pleased to introduce Mugambi Dewey.
How did America go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump? Why is modern America so intensely polarized? And how is this explained by American exceptionalism? To answer these questions, we must look at unique dimensions of American history, culture, politics, and beyond. That is what American exceptionalism has historically meant, that America is an exception within the Western world. This may surprise you, because many people nowadays think that American exceptionalism means a faith in American superiority, that America is a special country chosen by God to be a beacon of light to the world. From this angle, exceptionalism would mean exceptional in the sense of outstanding, phenomenal, or superior. However, historically, American exceptionalism has primarily meant that America is an exception, objectively and descriptively, especially compared to other Western democracies, European countries, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And in my book, I argue that the extraordinary polarization of modern America is a dimension of what American exceptionalism truly means. Again, exceptionalism means an exception. So America is the only modern Western democracy to still have the death penalty, and is the only one to lack a universal healthcare system. And these are not inherently good or bad things. It all depends on what you think of the death penalty or universal healthcare. And these are types of questions that profoundly divide Americans. And they call into question the common narrative that America and Europe are now alike. And it's true. We see similar phenomena on both sides of the Atlantic with the rise of anti-immigrant, nativist, populist movements with Donald Trump's movements in America and far-right European parties. However, people tend to overlook that America still is very different and that Americans routinely clash over a broad range of fundamental questions that are either not controversial or much less controversial elsewhere in the modern Western world, such as whether people should have a basic right to healthcare, whether special interests should be allowed to spend unlimited money on political campaigns and on lobbying, whether climate change is a hoax, a myth, or a scientific reality, whether creationism or the theory of evolution should be taught in public schools, whether women should have a right to abortion, whether contraception should be provided as part of people's health insurance programs, whether abstinence-only sexual education or comprehensive sexual education should be taught, whether people should have an unbridled right to bear arms, whether to have the death penalty, whether to have mass incarceration on a scale not only unprecedented in American history, but virtually unprecedented in the history of humankind, and whether it is appropriate to reintroduce torture into Western civilization as a means of fighting terrorism. Europeans tend to have vigorous and acrimonious debates, but these are not the types of issues that tend to divide them, barring a few exceptions, such as abortion in Ireland and Poland. And as I look at the path of American democracy in my book, I also trace my own path in this country. Unlike Barack Obama, I was actually born in Kenya. My father is Kenyan, my mother is French, from Brittany, the Celtic region of France. And after being born in Nairobi, I grew up in Paris, not very far from the Eiffel Tower, in a multicultural environment, speaking French with my mom and English with my dad. But my roots are in America, in a sense, because my parents met at Columbia University in New York as international students. I first set foot in the United States when I was 8 years old. I visited my father, who had become a professor in California, and from then on, I became fascinated by this country, by its cities, its landscapes, its culture, its people. So when I went back to Paris, America was never far away from my mind. I spent a lot of time thinking about this country, consuming American popular culture, from movies to music, reading about American history, and enjoying American literature. I also came back to America a few times on vacation as a teenager, and ultimately, I decided to move to America for college. So when I was 17, I left Paris, France, for not Paris, Texas, but for Houston, Texas, to attend Rice University. It's a tremendous institution. I learned a lot there, and also had a chance to broaden my horizons. I experienced Southern hospitality. I also met people who were very warm and welcoming, but also faced a culture shock, because I saw things that I had never seen before in France, such as people who routinely said grace before meals, people who held fervent evangelical beliefs, and people who had never left their country, even though they were part of the middle class, except perhaps to go to Cancun. Now, of course, the South is a land of diversity in every sense of the word, from demographic diversity and diversity in terms of people's beliefs, but still, these types of traits are quite common in red states. And after my time in the Bible Belt, I also spent time living in New York City, in Chicago, spent time in New England, in California, Washington, D.C., Georgia, Alabama. And what struck me was not only the huge contrast between America as a whole and France or other Western nations, but the huge contrast within the United States. Now, this may seem obvious at first. Of course, everyone knows that a regional divide has been a big part of American history, and that was, of course, part of the driving factor behind the Civil War between North and South. But people tend to overlook is that a regional divide of this magnitude is extraordinary by international standards. If you leave Paris for more rural regions of France, you may meet people who are more conservative. By the same token, if you leave Amsterdam for more rural regions of the Netherlands, you may meet people who are more conservative, so on and so forth. But you will rarely meet people who widely think that universal health care is a tyranny of socialized medicine, that climate change is a hoax, that everyone should have the right to bear arms, and that abortion is one of the greatest evils that the world has ever known. But these are common beliefs in red states. However, looking at the data, we see that there's not only a major regional divide in America today, there's also a major partisan divide that transcends regional differences, and that even blue state Republicans tend to take very hardline and peculiar positions on a broad range of issues. Case on point, Donald Trump. He's a New Yorker. And two of his main supporters during his very hardline, very provocative, and quite far-right presidential campaign, which was filled with conspiracy theories, were blue state Republicans, including Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of liberal New York City, and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. And this reflects a much broader phenomenon that started well before Donald Trump's election, namely what political scientists call asymmetric polarization, which is an empirical phenomenon indicating that over the last 30 years, the Republican Party has moved significantly more to the right than the Democratic Party has moved to the left. And that calls into question the conventional wisdom of both sidesism, that today America is polarized because both sides take just as extreme and radical positions. That is contradicted by both quantitative and qualitative evidence. In fact, as I explain in my book, today's American liberals are often closer to other Westerners than to American conservatives on a broad range of issues. That the average American liberal is likelier to agree with a French, British, German, or Canadian person on universal health care, gun control, or climate change than to agree with a fellow American conservative. And that's also reflected in striking data that I cite in my book. During the 2012 US presidential election, opposing Barack Obama to Mitt Romney, a poll found that a striking 90% of Europeans would have voted for Obama over Romney. That means that even European conservatives are far likelier to identify with American liberals and a Democratic Party than with American conservatives and the Republican Party. By the same token, in the 2016 US presidential election, an international poll covering approximately 3/4 of the global population found overwhelming support for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. And that's because American conservatives have largely become outliers in the modern Western world because of their peculiar ideology, which has been a driving factor behind asymmetric polarization, which is itself a big factor behind the extraordinary polarization of modern America, which I argue is a dimension of what American exceptionalism truly means. Now, of course, some of you again may say, wait, American exceptionalism, isn't that really the belief that America is a special country chosen by God to be a beacon of light to the world? Well, no. Well, not really. At least that is not what the concept has predominantly meant throughout history. Some people trace the concept of American exceptionalism to Alexis de Tocqueville, or Tocqueville with an American accent, the Frenchman who traveled to the United States in the 1830s and wrote the masterpiece, Democracy in America. And it's true that Tocqueville wrote that America is an exceptional country, but he meant that America is an exception. Yes, he praised Americans in many ways, such as for their trailblazing democratic institutions, for their sense of innovation, for their sense of civic duty as well. But he could be critical of Americans in other ways, such as for their common support for slavery, mistreatment of Native Americans, and for what he often felt was a sense of anti-intellectualism and materialism among his interlocutors. Tocqueville did not believe that America is inherently superior, and he apparently, as far as we know, never used the precise phrase American exceptionalism. Ironically, most scholars have traced the origins of this phrase to American communists. We used it in the 1920s to argue that the so-called universal laws of Marxism would have to evolve differently in America because of its distinct set of social and economic conditions. In particular, Jay Lovestone, who then was the president of the American Communist Party, advanced his theory of American exceptionalism, and that did not sit well with Stalin. And when Lovestone was on a visit to Moscow, after a tense meeting, Stalin had him detained, and Lovestone barely escaped with his life. He was later expelled from the Communist Party. And after these origins to the phrase, American exceptionalism started being used primarily by academics who studied the different ways in which America is an exception within the Western world, such as historians, political scientists, and legal scholars. And it was not before the Obama presidency that the phrase American exceptionalism became to be widely used in the U.S. Political debate. Now, some of you may say, wait, isn't the idea that America is inherently superior a much older idea? Think about John Winthrop, The City Upon a Hill. And yes, it's true that ever since Europeans came to North America, many were convinced that they had found a new world, that it could mold into a perfect society, and that Native Americans did not have a right to their land. Some founding fathers also believed that Providence was on their side as it founded the great American democracy that we have today. And in the 19th century, there was the emergence of another phrase called Manifest Destiny in 1845, which referred to the fact that America had a God-given right to expand westward and take over land from Mexico and Native Americans, and also to thwart the claims of European powers to North American land. But these ideas were not called by the precise phrase American exceptionalism. And according to data, the phrase American exceptionalism was not widely used in the U.S. political debate before Obama entered the White House. And we see that references to American exceptionalism skyrocketed around the time Obama was elected. And I explain in my book that this is because leaders of the Republican establishment started routinely accusing Obama of not believing in American exceptionalism, of betraying the heritage of the founding fathers, and of trying to transform America into Europe, or at best, Canada, with his un-American and socialist agenda. I provide quotations from key Republican leaders, such as John Boehner, Jeb Bush, and Mitt Romney, defining American exceptionalism as a faith in American superiority and accusing Obama of not believing that America is exceptional. And Obama and other Democrats responded by trying to co-opt the phrase and saying that, yes, they do believe in American exceptionalism. And as some politicians, especially leaders of the Republican establishment, started emphasizing the phrase American exceptionalism, which also made its way for the first time into the GOP's official platform, some people went further in not only accusing Obama of lacking American values, but also of lacking an American identity. There was a spread of conspiracy theories alleging that Obama is not really American because he has a forged U.S. birth certificate, that he was secretly born in Kenya. There also were conspiracy theories that Obama is a covert Muslim with jihadi sympathies. Among the main proponents of these conspiracy theories were Donald Trump. And the birther conspiracy theory seemed to fit with the political strategy that Donald Trump adopted in his subsequent presidential campaign, targeting undocumented immigrants. Because if you think about it, if Obama were to have a forged U.S. birth certificate, This would mean that Obama himself is an undocumented immigrant, because you're not documented if you have forged papers. So that would make Obama himself part of the vilified group of undocumented immigrants that became part of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. And as there was much talk about American exceptionalism in those times, and also about the extraordinary polarization of American society, people did not connect the two together. But I do so in my book, explaining that the extraordinary polarization of American society is a dimension of what American exceptionalism has historically meant. Thank you.
You are listening to Cambridge Forum and Harvard Square as we continue our examination of exceptional America with author and Stanford Law Fellow, Mugambi Jue. You hit upon some very interesting points, language being one, the semantics of how language can now mean whatever you want it to mean. And last week it meant this, and this week it means something else. When did America start to equate opposition with anti-Americanism? You're able to say someone is acting in an anti-American fashion, which implies they're unpatriotic, whatever that means, but you never have to define Americanism. So when did this start to be a phenomenon?
It's arguably a longstanding phenomenon. Accusing people of having un-American values, of course, played a big role during the Red Scare and under McCarthyism. But it also reflects a broader pattern in politics, which is impugning people's patriotism. But what's interesting is that this claim is also not only made by American conservatives, but also by American liberals who accuse their opponents of being an American, such as when they call for banning Muslims from entering America. And that's because there are many different conceptions of what it means to be an American and to share American values.
Okay, well, anyone like to pose questions, please come up to the microphone.
Let me take your incarceration. Incarceration facts are known. We know it doesn't work. I mean, it's been proved again and again. It's racially biased dropouts. Blacks and Hispanics make the core of it. So if we know it, why is it still there?
It's a reflection of the evolution of the American social contract in many ways, the harshening of social attitudes, disfavoring compassion, the growing acceptance of inequality and of discrimination, not only against racial and ethnic minorities, but also against poor whites, who represent a significant segment of prisoners as well. And it's worth noting that at least for some time, there seemed to be reason for hope, because there was the growth of a relatively bipartisan consensus towards criminal justice reform. However, Donald Trump distanced himself from Republicans who had been calling for criminal justice reform. In fact, he proposed to make the penal system even harsher as part of his presidential campaign. And once elected, he made Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, someone who's resolutely opposed to criminal justice reform, and recently instructed prosecutors in the federal system to systematically seek the harshest sentences possible, which is very striking, again, because America has mass incarceration essentially on world record levels. And a lot of experts have called into question whether mass incarceration helps reduce crime. And even if it could, it's very clear that it could be achieved by other means. Say, if you look at other Western democracies, they have a much lower murder rate than America, even though they're much less likely to incarcerate and they don't have the death penalty.
I wonder if it would be helpful to have a more to have a discussion about basic values in this country. You know, I think about Reverend William Barber and his whole move toward the moral revival, and actually to be being explicit about what we would call progressive values. And I wonder if we don't have shared values across this huge divide, and yet different interpretations of how to get to where we want to go. And I think about in terms of climate change that, you know, there are fundamentalists who are saying, let's take care of God's creation. So I wonder if that's somehow an approach that we should pay more attention to. And I would say, as an old-time left-wing person, that I think we've been shy about espousing what our basic values are.
The real question, of course, are what are people's basic values? And the basic values shared by American conservatives today are very different than those shared by American liberals. It's true that Americans should probably learn more about some of the key figures of U.S. history, such as Franklin Roosevelt, who not only led the Allies to victory in World War II, but played a big role in the economic revival following the Great Depression, and also built a more equal society with the New Deal economic model. And perhaps learning more about these figures can provide a more nuanced perspective about what the government could do in terms of reducing wealth inequality, for example.
I have been consoling myself in this mess by saying to myself, well, when everybody my age is dead, it will be much better. The young people have a different slant, and technology is going to change dramatically. So if we could just bumble through 20 years, it should change enough to make everything better. How do you respond to that?
There are different scenarios about how America could evolve in the future. One possibility is that Donald Trump's rhetoric and political style may become normalized. We see, for example, that he has an 84% approval rating among Republicans, according to Gallup. And that suggests that his rhetoric, his agenda are not seen as abnormal among these supporters. It could also be that there'll be a backlash within conservative America, just like there's been a backlash among American liberals. And there may also be a generational shift, as you mentioned. So today, younger Americans, for example, tend to be more tolerant about gay rights. So that would, for example, call into question the success of a political strategy that would stigmatize or target gay people in the future. And the country is also growing more diverse in a racial and ethnic sense. And this also may pose problems for a political strategy that is very nativistic in its approach. But that also may be part of the issue, and that may be why Donald Trump has been able to galvanize many supporters. And there's a striking study that I cite in my book, which indicates that most white Americans today think that there's more racism against whites than against blacks. And it goes without saying that Mr. Trump seemed to tap into this fear quite well.
I'd just like to thank Mugambi Jue for joining up so many interesting historical lines between cause and effect. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to part one of Exceptional America, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with author and Stanford Law Fellow Mugambi Jue. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute and friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us, and do come again.